live or eventually recorded for some of you, or for those who are in here. We'll be in Exodus chapter 22 this evening, Exodus chapter 22. Exodus chapter 22, we're going to start in verse 5 in a moment. So imagine this scenario. You borrow your neighbor's lawnmower. And let's say it's a really nice lawnmower. It's like a Honda or something like that, okay? Not a cheap, you know, I don't want to run down certain brands, but the church bought one here for a push mower about 2 years ago. And we actually bought two of them, and one was a better one. And I thought, I'll buy a backup because I was going to have two people pushing the mower. And so we'll buy a cheaper one and a nicer one. It was not worth it to buy the cheaper one because that brand, you mowed once with it and things were already broken on it and things like that. So you buy a nice one. I mean, you know, a really nice one. We're not necessarily a riding mower, but just, you know, a push mower. Your neighbor says, I need to borrow your mower. I got a mow and mine's broken down and this happens. But let's say you borrowed your neighbor's mower. Yours was broken down. You borrow their mower and you go away for an evening. And when you come home, your house has been broken into. And your lawnmower is fine because it's broken, so they didn't take it. But they see this nice Honda, and they take it. And they take a bunch of other valuables from your house. And it's enough that you make an insurance claim. So you make an insurance claim, and there's $5,000 of things stolen out of your house. And the insurance company replaces those things. But, of course, there's a deductible, right? So you have a $500 or $1,000 deductible on this. But let's say there's not enough with the deductible that you're given from insurance. There's not enough to replace your neighbor's lawnmower. Are you responsible for their lawnmower having been stolen from your house? Okay? Now I'm seeing various people, I'm seeing a lot of heads nod, like, of course. This passage talks about these kinds of obligations. That is, what responsibility do you have in certain situations when you've borrowed somebody's things or caused some damage to their property? Now, this is not life and death issues. We've looked at life and death issues in a previous chapter. But here we're looking at property issues. And these are specific laws in the Old Testament. In this passage, it's called the Book of the Covenant, Exodus 21, 22, 23. It's called the Book of the Covenant. And in this, what we find is somewhat of case laws or examples. Okay, this is somewhat application of the principles that are taught in the Ten Commandments. In the Ten Commandments, there's a thou shalt not steal, right? Which implies that you can't take what belongs to somebody else, which then implies that you own something and they own something. In other words, that private property exists. And so in this section, this is really about private property. And when somebody owns something, what liability or responsibility do you have when you borrow their things? Okay? So we'll see here, Exodus 22, verse 5. If a man shall cause a field or vineyard to be eaten, and shall put in his beast, and shall feed in another man's field, of the best of his own field, and of the best of his own vineyard, shall he make restitution. So here's what this passage says, okay? You've got two farmers, and one of them goes, you know, I'm running out of grass in my field. I'm going to let my cow loose in the other field. Okay? And the cow goes over there and starts eating, you know, his grass, or eating his wheat, or something else. What liability is there? Well, that's not his ground to do that with. This other farmer next door has worked hard to keep up his farm. And so what is the responsibility here? In other words, this is a kind of theft, if you would. All right, you're using somebody else's stuff. You're using his field. And so the consequence of this is the very best of your field is to be paid in restitution. Okay, you don't get to choose what's paid. All right, and the implication is that there were some judges involved, probably the elders of the city, who would come in and say, okay, the fair restitution is this corner of your field which has the best grass, or this corner of your field that's growing the best wheat or has the best vineyard, those are the grapes you have to give him for the loss. In other words, you're responsible for the damage you caused to his field, for the theft that took place in his field. Again, as I've mentioned before, this is why in our society we have insurance, because we do have accidents that like this that take place, right? I remember driving along one time, and this was in the 90s, and I was driving what was called at the time, I grew up in Detroit area, and so we knew the names of some of the like platforms of the cars. But it was called what was called a K-car, but it was like a Plymouth Reliant or a Dodge 600 or some of these kind of things. They were disposable cars. They were inexpensive cars that went about 100,000 miles and then they were worn out. Okay, and so for just basic transportation, they were usually a little under $10,000 brand new. And you could drive one of these cars. They were a little four-cylinder, 2.2 liters, I think, with about 85 horsepower or something. They weren't much. But they were good, reliable transportation to about 100,000 miles, and then the head gaskets would leak over and the transmissions would fail, and all kinds of things would go wrong with them. But for that 100,000 miles, you had reliable transportation. And so I was driving one of these, and it was old. And the paint didn't look so good. And my sister had been driving it, and somebody changed lanes into her, and there was a big dent in a fender. And it wasn't worth that much, so it wasn't even worth making an insurance claim on to get it fixed. And I'm driving along one day, and this guy goes to change lanes into me. He's not looking. And he almost changes lanes into me, but he was in an AMG Mercedes. And, and then he gets all mad at me because, I don't know, he missed me. I didn't move. I was just driving in my lane, and he's yelling, you know, wonderful greetings out the window and stuff at me, as people often do when they get upset when they're driving on the road. And I remember thinking, this is going to bother you a lot more than me if you run into me. You know, you might want to drive that Mercedes a little more carefully, because if you run into my car, I kind of suspect that if you can afford that Mercedes, you can afford to fix my car. And it's not really going to do, you know, if as long as it's drivable, I'm going to keep driving it because this is just wheels for me. I'm not taking it to the car show. That's not what it is. But we realize this, that I could be driving on the road and I could be driving a really nice car. I could be driving a really bad car. And if I cause a car accident, I'm at fault and there's going to be some responsibility for that. Okay. Or if, for example, I use up what belongs to someone else, I borrow theirs and I use up what belongs to someone else, I have a responsibility. And here the idea is that the restitution is high enough that it would discourage people from doing this. In other words, this keeps you from going, oh, I'm so sorry that my cow happened to wander into your field. Because you know that if that happens, you're going to pay a restitution. Verse 6, if fire break out and catch in thorns, so that the stacks of corn or the standing corn or the field be consumed therewith, he that kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. Now we're assuming here this isn't intentional arson. This is accidental. One word about this idea of corn. Okay? King James uses this word corn. Corn is not what we think when we say corn. Okay, when we say corn, we think maize, corn on the cob, right? What's called maize traditionally. That's a North American crop that comes from North America. It didn't get over to Europe and didn't commonly get used in Europe until after the Age of Discovery. So even in 1611, when this is being translated, that wasn't the normal word. Even in England today, they tend to call what we call corn, they call sweet corn. And in much of Europe, it's not even used that frequently to eat by human beings. They might use it for animal feed. Same thing with peanuts. We like peanuts here. I like peanuts. But in Europe, they don't. They look, peanuts are like, ooh, that's low class. Why would you eat peanuts? But because I remember being in England one time, and we were with a group, and one of the young ladies went into Häagen-Dazs and looked at the ice cream flavors, and she's like, do you have chocolate peanut butter? Evidently, she had found that flavor in the United States. And the lady behind the counter said, this is Häagen-Dazs. We would never serve peanut butter. Like, that's low class. Why would you expect that? Now, in the United States, we don't think of peanut butter as low class, but that's the way they viewed it. But corn was the word for actually any kind of grain. So this is wheat, barley, whatever. That's the corn, okay? It's wheat. It's grain. It's the corn, the seed that you grind up into flour. So, So the idea is stacks of standing corn. You've picked the sheaves of wheat or barley, and they're stacked up and ready to be processed and turned into flour. But, so you've got your field and you've got all this harvest there, but remember, that's been picked, so it's dry. And somebody next door says, you know, I got all these thorns that I chopped down, and I'm going to set them on fire and burn them and get rid of them. But while he's doing this, the fire gets out of control. That can happen. A fire can get out of control. This was before I was born, but I heard the family history many times. My grandfather was burning trash, and they had a new home, and the whole area behind them was a large field that was unoccupied. And the wind blew the sparks and caught this whole grass field on fire. And it burned for a half a mile to the main road. And the fire department had to come and put it out. And my grandmother never let my grandfather forget that he caused this fire. Now, thankfully, it didn't burn anybody's home, and the grass wasn't really of value and anything like that. But it was an accidental fire. You know, he was doing something legal. It was legal to burn trash at the time, and he was doing that. But that caught on fire. Now, thankfully, it didn't burn anyone's home down or burn up anybody's crops or anything like that. But what do you do? Okay? He that kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. There will be restitution made because you, in your liability, you have liability for starting this fire and letting it get out of control. That's the point. Okay? So the person who started the fire, not the person who grew the crops, whose crops get destroyed by the fire, but the person that started the fire, you're responsible, that person's responsible for whatever damage the out-of-control fire causes. Now, what we're recognizing here, this is not a malicious act, it's an accidental thing, but you still have a financial responsibility. Now, remember what we were saying? If you go back to chapter 21, verse 24, for example, verse 23, if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. We have this what's called the law of retribution. And the law of retribution is actually a limiting principle. What it's saying is a life is a life, an eye is not a life. So if you lose an eye, you don't get to see the other person executed. That's life and death kind of things. Here we're talking about property. Okay, but never in this property crimes do you ever find somebody executed for property crime. You don't find that take place. They're not killing people. They're causing property damage. And so, but nonetheless, there's a responsibility here. Verse 7. If a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and it be stolen out of the man's house, if the thief be found, let him pay double. So here's what it's saying. You borrow something, or your neighbor comes and says, hey, watch this for me. Keep it safe. And it gets stolen. If the thief is captured, he pays double. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he hath put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. So then you have an investigation. He says, oh, it was stolen. Well, do you think it would ever happen that you would give valuables to somebody and they would steal it and claim somebody else did? Human beings don't do that, do they? Happens all the time, right? That sometimes, you know, for example, shoplifting. Some of the price of what we pay for things in any store is you're paying for the shoplifting that's going on in that store. In order for that store to be profitable, they have to be able to write off the product that's being stolen. And a lot of times, that product is being stolen by employees who are supposed to be watching the store, right? They're supposed to be making sure the stuff sells, and that, but instead it's being stolen by the employees. I've used this example before, but remember years ago, Bill O'Grady was working here as our maintenance director, and on Mondays, usually our dumpster gets emptied, and it had just been emptied, and Bill was over in the garage, and he heard the lid of the dumpster close, and he thought, who's dumping stuff in our dumpster? Because he knew he wasn't throwing anything in there. So he went over and looked, and there were several bags of trash bags in the dumpster. So he opens it up, and he looks inside, and they're brand new clothes with tags. There used to be a Kmart right down the street here around the corner on Highway 50, right at 9th Street or so. And every one of these clothes in two or three large black trash bags full of clothes, all with Kmart tags on them. Well, I guarantee you this was not, you know, a shoplifter who stuffed these in their pockets. And what would happen is, you know, employees were sneaking it out the back door and smuggling it out, and then they were going to put it here as a drop to get their friends to come by and get it later, okay? There's a clean dumpster you can leave it in on Mondays. They figured that out. So Bill got it, and he put it on one of the carts here on property, and he's wheeling it. He was going to put it in the church and call the police. And as he's wheeling across the parking lot, this car pulls up, looks in the dumpster, and they go, where's our stuff? And then they look, they're like, that guy's got our stuff. And they drive over, and they're like, hey, you have our stuff. And he says, this looks like Kmart stuff to me. They're like, no, man, that's our stuff. And he's like, well, you know what? I think the Winter Garden police can solve this. And he pulls his phone out of his pocket and dials Winter Garden Police. And the one man was out of the car, and he was standing there talking to Bill, and the others were sitting in the car, and as soon as he said police, the car drove away fast. And the guy who was standing outside starts running, "Hey, wait for me!" And he's running after his friends who are driving away. Well, why? Because they were thieves, and they didn't want the police called, right? But they evidently had a thief inside of Kmart that was helping to steal this stuff. So it is possible that the people who are sometimes given a responsibility to watch over things could be the thieves themselves. You're no less a thief just because you have easy access. All right? I don't know if we've ever thought this. Some people think this, that if it was easy to steal it, then I have a right to it. If it was easy to steal, then I have a right to it. No, you don't. Okay? It's not yours. Even if nobody will ever notice, it's not right to take what's not yours. And so, in other words, an investigation is to be done. And obviously, then, if they determine this man didn't steal it, then he's not responsible for the theft. He's not held accountable. The thief is to be held accountable. But if they come to the conclusion that he stole it, then he's held accountable and he pays the restitution. For all manner of trespass, whether it be for an ox, for an ass, for sheep, for raiment, for any manner of lost thing which another challengeth to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, whom the judge shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. So he's saying, okay, so whatever it is, for all manner of trespass, a trespass, what does that mean? It means to cross a line you don't have the right to cross. We use it in the sense of walking onto somebody's property where we don't have the right to be. But the word trespass has the idea of crossing a line. In other words, passing a boundary you don't have the right to pass. So taking somebody else's ox is a trespass. That's the idea. Okay, you've crossed a boundary that you don't have the right to cross. That's their ox, not yours. For any kind of trespass, whether it be for an ox, okay, so this is a male, a cow, not a cow that's female, but, you know, bovine male that's usually used for pulling a plow. For an ass, that's a donkey. For sheep, okay, so these are their flocks. Remember, this is how people made their living. This is how they ate. If you didn't have some of these animals, you couldn't keep up your farm or your fields. For raiment, clothing. Now, in their day, clothing was much more difficult to come by than it is for us. I mean, you can, if you're not too picky, you can find nice, clean clothes that are in your size at Goodwill or Salvation Army thrift store or whatever and pay less than $10 and get an outfit. In some cases, it may not be the latest fashion, but you could have clean clothes that fit, you know. You can go to a discount place, you know, one of the discount retail stores like Walmart or somewhere like that. Or you could go to one of the places that have, you know, Ross or, you know, Marshall's or somewhere like that. And you can find clothes that are a lot more expensive other times and find the ones that are, you know, seconds or whatever they are, and buy them for a lot less expensive. So we're used to being able to go and buy clothes inexpensively. But in their day, clothing had to be made, which means someone had to sit there and take and make the thread and then turn that thread into cloth and then make that cloth into a garment. Okay? So we may have ladies in our church that sew. Great. That's a great skill to have. But almost none of them make their own cloth. As far as I know, none of them do. They go to the fabric store, right? They go to Walmart, to the fabric department, or they go to Hobby Lobby. Does Hobby Lobby have cloth? I think they do. I don't shop for this, you can tell. They go to Joann Fabrics or whatever, and they go to that place, and they buy cloth and cut it to what they need and you know, cut out the shapes and sew it together and do all of that. And so you find that, you know, they can make a garment, but they're not making the cloth. In the ancient world, you had to make the cloth. That means you get the wool from the sheep, you spin it into thread, you take the thread and you weave it into a garment. It's quite an extensive process. And because of the months and months of work that it took, if you were to purchase a garment, it would usually cost you the equivalent of about 300 to 365 days of labor for the average laborer. And by that, what I mean is the person who worked out in the field got a standard wage for their day's work out in the field. So if you were a farmer and you owned a lot of land, you'd hire some laborers to come and pick your grain or whatever. You'd pay them at the end of the day. Each one of them would get a certain amount. Okay? If they gathered up 300 days worth of that money, that's what it would cost them to buy a garment. So guess what? They didn't buy garments. Their wives made them. Now, wealthy people could afford to buy a garment because they had a lot of extra money and they could afford this. But this is a very valuable thing. So even though clothing might be stolen today, for the most part, that's not the kind of thing thieves usually target. If a burglar breaks into your house, they're not looking for your suit. Okay? They're like, where's the jewelry? Where's the electronics? Where's the computer? You know, if there's other things that are valuable in there, they're going to steal the things that they can easily, you know, send to the pawn shop or to the guy on the street at corner that they can sell it to and flip it real quick. That's the stuff they're looking for. But raiment was very, very valuable. So it was something that was a target of being stolen. Or any other manner of lost thing, which another challengeth to be his. Somebody else says, that's mine, and he stole it. The cause of both parties shall come before the judges. So they'll bring their cases here. And whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. Anybody that's found guilty of this theft pays double. In other words, this discouragement, if you just had to give it back, then what would happen is you'd say, oh, well, I'll take it, and then if I get caught, I just give it back. So there's no real risk, right? But if you have to give it back plus another one, you have to give back a garment plus another garment that's worth a year's wages, then that hurts too much. And so you're discouraged by wanting to do that. There is a cost to it. If a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep, and it die or be hurt or driven away, no man seeing it, then shall an oath of the Lord between them both be between them both, that he hath not put his hand into his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good. So here's what it says. So if a man delivers unto his neighbor a donkey or an ox or a sheep or any animal, maybe it's a camel or something else, to keep. So he says, hey, I've got to go on a journey. Could you make sure my ox gets fed while I'm gone? You know, your dog's sitting for somebody. You're watching their animal. But while that happens, it dies. That could happen. You could be watching somebody's dog and it could die while your dog's sitting. Or it gets hurt. I was house sitting for friends years ago and they had four dogs and three cats. And they had this one cat that was, he was a male, and he was always getting into scrapes and scraps. Like, he was the kind of cat that you let him out because he wanted to be outside, and he'd come home in the evening to get something to eat, and that was about it. And he'd usually bring you a present. There'd be a dead mouse on the step or something like that. Okay, but he was getting into it with other cats all the time, so he'd usually come home looking less good than when he left. And they were on vacation, and I was house sitting for them, and they'd call each day, and I had to tell them one time, I said, your cat, he won't let me get near him, but I think he got injured. And he did. He had a wound. He got in a fight with another cat, probably, and had a wound. Well, is that my fault? This had happened before when he was watching them. According to this passage, it's not my fault that cat got in a fight. So I'm not held accountable for that. Unless, as we say here, you take an oath. The person takes an oath and says, look, I didn't do this to the animal. I wasn't negligent in any way. It's just what happened. Okay? Or if it gets driven away, the dog runs off. It runs away. Dogs run away sometimes. Cats run away sometimes. If that happens while you're watching it or you've taken on responsibility for it, you're not held accountable. Obviously, the idea is there's an investigation to make sure nobody stole it. But if you just say, look, I was doing my best and the animal just got hurt, then after they take the oath, the owner of it says, yeah, he was watching out. He was doing what he could and this just happened. There's no restitution to be made. You're not responsible for this. The animal was being the animal, and you just happened to be the one making sure it got fed and taken care of. Then, because, in other words, an accident that's common to things, this is what happens. You borrow your friend's car. You don't have a car accident, but let's say you borrow your friend's car. Here would be another example. And while you're driving your friend's car, the alternator dies. Do you have to put a new alternator in it? No, it's not your car. See what I'm saying? Assuming you didn't do anything to kill the alternator. Or you're driving your friend's car and it's got 150,000 miles and the transmission falls out. not literally, but transmission's no good. Are you liable because it happened while you were driving it? Now, there could be a way that you would be. When I was in high school, senior year of high school, it was popular sometimes for people to take a half a day of school, and then if they had enough credits, and then do a half a day at a business where they'd do a co-op and they'd get some credit for that. And a friend of mine did this at General Motors. He got a co-op at General Motors, and he was learning a little drafting, and he was running blueprints back and forth and doing things like this. And his boss would say, okay, here's the keys to this car, and it was a fleet car, and you get to drive this General Motors car across town to drop this off. And sometimes he'd be in whatever, but occasionally they'd give him the keys to a Camaro. And I remember one time I was about to head to work. It was a couple hours till I was going to go to work, and it was in the afternoon. And he pulls up and he honks the horn, and I come out, and he's in this very nice Camaro. And he says, "Get in." So of course I'm 17 years old. Who's not going to get in the Camaro with your teenage friend, right? Was this the most responsible behavior in the world? No. But then he starts driving around, and he was not driving the speed limit. And it was an automatic transmission. And so he's doing neutral slams, revving the engine in neutral and dropping it into drive, and the wheels are squealing away and stuff. And I can see some of you cringing at how bad that is for the car. But it belonged to General Motors, not to him. So he figured, if something happens to it. And his boss said, "If anything ever happens to the car, just let us know, because we'll write it up and we'll investigate. And we'll just, that helps us to know where problems on these cars that we're manufacturing and stuff." Yeah, when you hand it to an 18-year-old and tell him to drive the Camaro. Now, so again, if you borrow your friend's Camaro and you do neutral slams and brake torques, burnouts, then, you're responsible for the damage to the vehicle because you were being negligent. But if your friend just says, "Hey, borrow my car while I'm out of town because you can use it," and something happens and it's the normal wear and tear of the vehicle, the owner is responsible for it. Okay? That's the principle that's in this passage. If you're house-sitting for somebody and while you're house-sitting, their garbage disposal stops working and you didn't do anything, you didn't feed half a cow down the garbage disposal or something like that. You just were putting a few vegetable clippings down the garbage disposal. They die sometimes. You're not responsible for it. That's the point. Verse 12. "And if it be stolen from him, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof." Now, here's the interesting thing. If a normal thing happens, but if you weren't guarding it, here's the point. If the thing is stolen, you weren't taking good care of it. So you have a liability, is the implication here. You didn't guard it. This is stealing. Sometimes in English we're sloppy, in modern English we're sloppy with these different words. To steal means to take what's not yours. Okay, sometimes we call things robbery that aren't robbery. Robbery means somebody takes it with the threat of force. So if somebody breaks into your home while you're not home and steals your stuff, that's burglary and stealing. They're stealing, and it's burglary because they broke in to get it. But it's not robbery if you're not home, because they just broke in and took it. If they come into your house and point a gun at you and say, "Where's the stuff?" that's robbery. Or if you're walking down the street and they point a gun or a knife at you and say, "Give me your wallet," that's robbery. They're threatening you with violence or using violence against you. That's robbery. Okay? Here, the idea is stealing. You weren't watching it and taking good care of it, so you're liable for the theft of the goods. Not that you're punished as the thief, but you're punished for not caring for it the way you should have. You were negligent in your care for it. "If it be torn in pieces, then let it bring him for a witness. He shall not make good that which is torn." Okay, so again, your neighbor's sheep's out there and a bear attacks it, a wolf attacks it, a lion attacks it. Okay, in this era, in ancient Israel, there were African lions in Israel. Africa's not that far away, and there were African lions in Israel. So you had these kinds of animals, and there were predators, and so this happens. Part of having flocks means that you have to defend them from predators, but you're not always successful. So as long as you could bring the remains, then you could use that as proof that this is what happened, and you weren't held liable for that. Okay, the reason you had to bring the remains was they didn't want people to go, "Oh, it got eaten by me and my family." Right? It got eaten by an animal. "And if a man borrow aught of his neighbor and it be hurt or die, the owner thereof being not with it, he shall surely make it good. But if the owner thereof be with it, he shall not make it good. If it be any hired thing, it came for his hire. So here's the idea. You have a man who lives next door to you, and he has a good ox, and you need to plow your field. And he says, hey, if you pay me rent, and I'll be there while you plow with the ox. I'll show you the ins and outs of how my ox behaves. Okay? If something happens to the ox while he's there, you're not liable. See the point? Okay? If the owner there be with it, he shall not make it good. In other words, there's no obligation here. The owner, it's like this. You get in a taxi, and the taxi driver drives you somewhere. If the taxi driver has a fender bender, you're not liable for the dent in the taxi. However, if you go rent a car, what do you think Hertz is going to say if you dent it? They're going to say you owe them money. And it's always more than you'd pay if you had to fix your own car. So if you rent a car, they hold you accountable because you were responsible for it when it was away. And so it's the same idea here. If the owner's with it, you're hiring him for his expertise with that. You're not liable. He's the one who's responsible for it. But if he's not there, if a man borrow aught of his neighbor and it be hurt or die, the owner thereof shall not being with it, he shall surely make it good. In other words, you have to pay him back because you didn't take good care of the item that was there. I've had a car accident in a rental car. Okay, years ago I had a car, and I was in a rental car, and I was on Oakland Avenue in Oakland, and you got to Tubb and Oakland Avenue. There's a stop sign there, 4-way stop. And when I stopped there, the guy behind me, it was after dark, the guy behind me, I see he's coming, and I'm like, he's not stopping, and he's driving a Suburban, and I was in a rented Dodge Caliber, which isn't a very big car. And so as soon as I saw he wasn't stopping, I let off the gas and started to give, I let off the brake and started to give it gas to try to get through the intersection. And he smacked into the back of me, and we played Dodge'em cars a little bit where, you know, I went a little faster than I was going because he ran into me. But he put a big dent. I couldn't open the trunk. But when I had rented the car, I had bought their insurance. You know, they said, do you want to buy the insurance on this? I bought the insurance on it. And so I bought the insurance, and when I took the car back, I said, I'm sorry, there was an accident. I got a police report number for them. And I took it back and said, I'm sorry, there was an accident. Somebody rear-ended me. The guy had been drinking and driving, I think. By the time the police, we got his license plate, but by the time the police tracked him down, he was sober. But I went to the rental car place, and when I returned it, they were like, oh, this is going to cost a lot of money. And then I said, oh, I bought the insurance. And you should have seen their faces. They were not happy. Because that insurance, you know, it's not like you're buying that insurance from Allstate or State Farm. It's self-insured. So in other words, when you pay them that extra, they agree they'll pay for whatever damages happen as long as it wasn't intentional. And so, you know, they're like, oh, bummer, he bought the insurance, you know, because otherwise I'd have been on the hook to buy it, to fix it. And so, but, you know, they're looking at this like, oh, why, you know, you're going to owe us for fixing our car, which is the way it happens, right? So the same idea here. If it's a rental and you have the person's object, you're responsible for it while you're renting it from them. If it's the person driving it or the person operating it or the person coming along, it's for hire, that's a different story, okay? So these are all different, you know, we've gone through all these different scenarios, but there's some principles here. And that is, when you are, to kind of narrow it down, when you are responsible for somebody else's property, you're responsible for it. You owe them if something happens. In other words, when you've taken on that obligation, when it's normal wear and tear, or when the person is that you've rented it from or borrowed it from is the one operating it, you're not responsible. So if your neighbor comes over and sees you putting in a new fence in the backyard and says, you know what, I've got an auger, let me bring it over. I don't get to use it very much. Let me help you dig the post holes. And he's like, rrr, rrr. And while he's putting holes in the yard, his auger motor dies. You don't have to pay him. He brought it over and he volunteered it, and it's his. Okay, if you're running it, then you might feel somewhat obligation to fix it for him. But again, this implies private property. There's some ownership here. So let's take a step back. Ownership implies creatorship. We don't talk about ownership in the animal kingdom generally. Okay, animals might fight over things, but there's no legal ownership. We don't say that dolphin owns this acre of the ocean, right? We don't do that. even with highly intelligent animals. These jellyfish own this beach. Now, sometimes they seem like they do, but we don't do that, right? This lion owns this savanna. No. Why? Because they're not made in God's image. As creatures made in God's image, as human beings, we're creatures made in God's image. We reflect the Creator because we're made in His image. And one of the things we do that reflects the Creator is to create things. Now, we're sub-creators. God created from nothing. Okay, so we, like I was saying, we might have some ladies who sew and they buy the fabric to make the fabrics harder. But you know what's even harder? Is to make the molecules that made up the fabric. Okay? In other words, if you had nothing and you have just a void and no universe, and all of a sudden you just make the atoms and the molecules that make up the universe, that's a lot more impressive. That's exactly what God did. He created from nothing. There was nothing and He made something. We remake things. In other words, we take this substance and mix them together and shape them and do various things, and we make stuff out of it. And we're creators. And it's not all of those things are objects. Okay, sometimes we might do woodworking and make something, or we might weld something together, or we might do those kinds of things. But sometimes these are thoughts. Somebody writes a book. It's not the paper that you have the copyright to. It's the thoughts that are on the page. It's the words that are on the page. Somebody writes a piece of music. Okay? That music, they have the rights to. They created it. Somebody makes a piece of art. They paint a painting. It's not the blue in the painting that they have the rights to. It's the image itself that they've created. Okay? So there's a creatorship there. Creatorship implies ownership. That's why the whole universe belongs to God. That's why the Bible says He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Well, wait, don't those cows belong to somebody else? Yeah, but He made them all. In other words, God owns everything. He made everything. And in the same way as human beings, if you make something, it's yours. Okay, you have a piece of land, you go down, you cut down a tree. Maybe you got an old tree and you cut it down. You take and you mill the wood and you turn the wood into a nice piece of furniture. You own that furniture. You can do a lot of things with it. You can keep it. Say, look, I made this, and use it. You can go somewhere and sell it and get the money, and then the person who buys it, they own it now because they bought it from the creator of the object. But creatorship implies ownership. We are indirect creators of our children, even in a sense. Obviously, God makes all people, but the fact is we all understand that there's a parental relationship with children. And who gets to name the children? The parents. Well, why? Because they're the sub-creators of those children. Does that make sense? In other words, other people don't name your children. There's not a bureau of child naming in our government, thankfully. But you could have that, where other people want the right to name your children. But no, you have... you choose their name. Why? Because they're your children, and you have a responsibility over them until they become adults and they're on their own. But until then, they belong to you. That doesn't mean they're property in the same sense that your car is. They're human beings that have to be respected and made in the image of God, that have to be treated as image bearers of God, and they'll be loved and nurtured, and they have eternal souls who need Jesus as their Savior, and they need to hear the gospel. So there's all kinds of things about children that's different than property. So I'm not saying they're merely property, but there is a relationship there, okay, a hierarchical relationship there that is there because of the relationship of parent to child. And so therefore, parents have this responsibility over their children. That's actually been one of the debates in recent years, right, in our school districts. Who has the right to determine what children are taught in the school district? And there's a lot of educators out there who are more progressive who are saying, you know, parents are too closed-minded and we need the open-minded teachers to determine what children really get to know. And you parents need to stop sticking your noses in all this, because we're going to make a better society by re-educating your children from the bigoted things that you've taught them. This is being said by people, and there are politicians that are saying this kind of thing. They usually lose, thankfully, recently. Because most parents go, no, wait a second. This teacher who's going to have the student for 1 year in a classroom doesn't care about and love my child as much as I do as the parent. And I should be the one as a parent to determine what my child is taught. And if I don't like what you're teaching them, then I'll go to a different school. Okay? And especially on these moral issues, right? I mean, this idea that somehow we need to be teaching kindergartners about homosexuality and stuff is just perversion. That's not trying to help them. They don't need to learn these things. They're too young. Okay, it's a part of life. I recognize that. It's something that as adults we know about. But that doesn't mean a five-year-old needs to cope with this. I always appreciate the story that was told. Corrie ten Boom, who was a survivor of the Holocaust, remembered when she was a little girl one time, she had overheard a conversation about a man, and they had mentioned in the conversation that the man was involved in a sexual sin. And as a little girl, she didn't know what that meant. So she was traveling with her father, who was a watch repairman, clock and watch repairman, and he had his samples case with him. And they were on the train, and she said, "Daddy, what does sexual sin mean?" And he pulled his samples case down as they were getting off the train, and he said, "Could you carry this for me?" And she said, she tried to pick it up. She said, it's too heavy. And he said to her, "So I will carry it for you. Because I'm an adult, and I will carry it for you. There are some things that are like that in life. Let me carry some things for you right now, and later when you're big enough, you can carry them." And we need to do that for children. In other words, we need to recognize some things are too heavy for them to carry, and when they're old enough, they can know about it, and they can, and that's good, okay, for them to learn. Even that there's evil in the world, they need to know that, but it needs to be done at their level, okay? When you're five, he's a bad guy. You don't go into Jeffrey Dahmer and everything he did to somebody. You just say he was a bad guy. Okay, and they know he was the bad guy. Okay, he's scary, he's the bad guy. And there are bad guys out there, and you need to be careful of bad guys. They need to know that. That's fine. But you don't tell them all the details of all the gruesome things they did. That's not appropriate for a five-year-old. And the fact that a parent wants to protect their child in that kind of instance is not the parent being cruel or trying to make a poor society or trying to abuse other people. This is a parent protecting their child, and parents have the right to make decisions about protecting their children. It's a biblical principle. The Bible very clearly teaches that the primary responsibility of teaching biblical values to children lies on the parents. That means as parents, we will be held accountable for that. And that means, too, that other people don't get to usurp that responsibility. Okay, now, the church has a responsibility to teach the scriptures to the children that come here, right? But that's not the only responsibility. If you bring your child to church and they don't learn the Bible, we have some responsibility. But the primary responsibility, if your children don't know anything about the Bible, is on you, not on us. Does that make sense? We'll do our best, and we do believe, I think we've taken very seriously teaching the Word of God to young people here. There are some churches that just entertain during children's programs. We don't want to do that. We want them to learn the Bible and the principles from it and what it says. But the fact is, if you send your child to Sunday school and there's some things they didn't learn from the Bible that you think they should have learned, I'm going to ask you, what did you tell them at home? And if you haven't talked about Jesus or the Bible at home, then I think you have neglected a biblical responsibility that you have, okay? So, in other words, there is a responsibility here of creatorship, of ownership, of these kinds of things, and there's a responsibility there that can't be usurped, that applies to children in many ways. It applies to the things that we have. And again, I'm not getting into politics in the sense that I'm worried about this election that's coming up, okay? I mean, I have concerns about it as a citizen. But I'm not so much saying here's what we should do in the coming election, as what I'm saying is there's biblical principles that we should abide by as Christians, and those will inform how we get involved. But one of the biblical principles is that the Bible very clearly teaches the idea of private property. Okay, there's some out there who think private property is an evil idea. It's not an evil idea. It's a biblical idea. When people take responsibility for their own stuff, things go better. I saw a quote recently. There was a very popular rock star named Bono, who was the lead singer for a group called U2. And I'm not necessarily advocating the group, but for a long time he was a bit of a progressive activist and said, you know, maybe if we pooled all our resources, we could solve all the problems in the world and stuff. And then recently he made this quote. He's in his 60s now, and he said, you know, I used to think this, but now I realize that if we taught people how to be entrepreneurial and take responsibility for their own lives, it would solve a lot more problems than pooling all the resources. Now, it took them a little while to come to that conclusion, but the fact is that's actually a more biblical conclusion. The Bible does teach that we should help those who are in need. But helping those who are in need and rewarding those who won't work for themselves are two different things. In other words, you take responsibility for your own life. You go get a job if you're healthy enough. Obviously, people get older, people get sick, they need our help. But if you're old enough to go get a job and to pay for your own way, and again, we baby sometimes our, we get extended adolescence in America. But, you know, I've had this conversation multiple times with people in counseling where they're like, well, my son, he can't work more than 20 hours a week. How old is he? 28? I'm like, what? Yeah, he's had a lot of stress in life. And I remember looking at him, what did you do at 20 years? What were you doing at 28 years old? Oh, I had 3 kids. Yeah. Why is it they can't do this? There should be some responsibility here. Okay? Tell them. The Bible says it's good for a young man to bear the yoke in his youth. It's good. Our young people should learn to work. We live in a culture that works to play, right? You work so that you can go play some more. And the fact is that if you make it, think of this. If we're sub-creators and part of the way that we show the image of God is by creating, you don't create through play as much as you do through work. This is why when we ask people things about their life, we often ask them, what do you do for work? It doesn't mean that's the only thing that defines you, but work is a noble, good thing. And so we should teach our children this, not that work is bad. Now, you can have a bad job that you hate, I understand that, and want to find different work. That's okay. But the idea that work is always bad is not a biblical idea. It is not a better use of your life to play video games all day than to work. It is not a better use of your life to play around doing nothing than it is to work. Now, we all get to the place in life where we put in our work and we're getting older and tired and retire and those kinds of things. And that's fine. That's noble. You saved up enough money to be able to do that. You can do that. You paid into Social Security, all that. I'm not preaching against that. But what I'm saying is people who just won't work, the Bible says if a man won't work, not can't work, not can't find work, but he won't work, he ought not to eat. Guess what? You'll be very motivated if you don't have anything to eat. You'll go, hey, how do I get more food? Guess what? Do this work. And you'll eat. Okay, I'm hungry. I'll do that. And so this whole idea that somehow if we had no private property, we'd live in this utopia, that assumes also something else that's unbiblical, and that assumes the idea that there isn't depravity. And this whole passage assumes depravity that we've read, right? It assumes that people are going to pretend to have borrowed something and actually stolen it, or pretend that it was lost and eaten by an animal when they ate it themselves. It's assuming that human beings might try to do this kind of thing. We have to assume that people will do bad things at times. So we can't just trust everybody. There has to be accountability in all kinds of areas. Accountability. And we, you know, businesses understand this. We understand this. That, for example, when we take up offerings here, when the offering is taken up, the men who take it up all stand there together and put it in the bag that's then put in the safe. Well, why? Because we don't want just one person to do that. There'd be a temptation to take something. When the offering's counted, it's not just one person counting it. It's multiple people counting it. Last week, there were 3 people who counted the offering. Why? Because it's a lot harder to steal when there's other people watching you. We're not doing this because I assume those people are all thieves, but we just don't want to be a temptation to anybody. Guess what? A person who's not normally a person whose habit is to steal things, there's just now no temptation. They're not even thinking of it. They're just doing their job. But somebody has a financial need and there's money sitting there and nobody might know if they take it. There's a temptation. Let's take that temptation away, right? Because people are basically sinners. The idea that if we had, you know, shared property, everybody would equally work hard and would do their share assumes that people aren't depraved and aren't sinners. And that's not a biblical assumption. That's an unbiblical assumption. People wouldn't take advantage of something, would they? Now, you know, the theme parks, for example, they charge an awful lot of money. They have the right to charge whatever they want to charge to get in there, but they charge an awful lot of money. But I knew somebody who had a child who was much older than the age of what you could get in for free, what it is, under 3 or something like that, that you can get into the theme parks for free. This child was like 6 or 7. But she was young for her, she was young for her age. No, she was small for her age. But so they had her, they dressed her in clothes that looked younger and had her in a stroller when she didn't usually need one so that they could get to the park and claim that she was under 3 years old, and Disney didn't question it. But they basically, that's theft. Your child's 6 years old, you're supposed to pay to get in. I know we can go, oh, that place charges an arm and a leg to get in. Yes, they do. If you don't want to pay it, don't go. But you don't have a right to steal from them because you think they charge too much. Does that make sense? Okay. Just because they're a big corporation with a lot of money doesn't mean you get to try to cheat them. That's not the way it works. You pay what you owe to get in. You do your business honestly. And so, again, we have this kind of principle of being honest when we borrow somebody's stuff, when we use people's things, we try to take care of it. You know, and again, the principle most of us were probably raised with is you borrow something from your neighbor, you return it better than you found it. Right? If he loaned you a shovel and it was muddy when you borrowed it, you wash it off when you return it, it looks better. Because, you use it, so you did a little maintenance on it for him. If your neighbor says you can borrow my car, you return it with a full tank of gas, right? And maybe a car wash or whatever. You do more and beyond what was expected of you. And that's the righteous way to do it. And so we have these principles from the Bible. These are good principles. These haven't changed as far as righteousness. We might have different situations. Most of them are not borrowing oxen from our neighbors. I recognize that. But we are still the same kind of parallel situations exist in a little different technological society. And we have those same obligations. All right. Do we have some questions tonight? Zero. Okay, no questions. Those of you joining us on the live stream or anybody in here, if you ever have any question, maybe a question about what was in the message, or maybe a question just about the Bible in general, I'll do my best to answer them. You can send those questions to calvarybaptistwg@gmail.com, and we'll do our best to answer them. If it's a question that I can answer just on the fly, I'll do my best with it. If it's a question that I don't know the answer to on the fly, I will say, let me get back to you next week, and I'll do some research and do my best to answer it for you. So I enjoy answering those questions, and I'm glad to take them. But if you don't have any, that's okay, too. But don't feel shy to ask the questions. All right. In the early days, we used to say who the question was from. I don't always do that now because, sometimes somebody's asking a question, and maybe they didn't realize the answer was more sensitive than it was and it embarrassed them. So we're not there to embarrass you. But again, we're not really welcoming anonymous questions. We do ask you to put your name on it because people can do silly things. We had people trolling us at the beginning where they were sending in silly questions on purpose, and we're not going to waste time on silliness. But so put your name on it, but we're not going to announce, here's a dumb question from so-and-so. We're going to try our best not to embarrass anybody.